It's kind of embarrassing, but I've come to the conclusion that if you accumulate gear, it's fine as long as you pass off the stuff that you're not using. And if I don't touch it in a year, it's gone.
Welcome to Big Red Canoe, the podcast from Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness, where we introduce you to captivating people and intriguing stories from America's treasured wilderness. I'm Dave Meyer. Grab a paddle and hop on in. Today we'll be talking about a topic that's a favorite for many paddlers, Boundary Waters canoe gear. So whether you're preparing for a fall trip or coming back from a summer one thinking, this trip could have been better with just that one little thing, when it comes to gear, it's fun to learn and very fun to dream. And we're lucky to be joined on the podcast by Darren Bush from Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison, Wisconsin. Needless to say, paddling and gear are a huge part of Darren's life. So welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So Darren, you were telling me you're not native to Wisconsin. Where are you from and how'd you get into canoeing and paddle sports? What's your background?
Well, I was born through no fault of my own in California and grew up in essentially near Calabasas. This is Kardashian land now. When I was there, it was actually, there were oaks and movie sets, and now it's pretty much gone. But I grew up in the water. My water was salty, but I lived about 8 miles from a really good surf break and spent time at the beach a lot and just did that. But I never felt completely comfortable there. I think I was a Midwesterner born there by mistake. So I came here in 1984 for my wedding reception. And I said to my father-in-law, why doesn't everybody live here? He said, I don't know. So we moved here 2 months later, and it's my home. So I consider myself to be a full-blown Midwesterner. I love Wisconsin. I love Minnesota. I love the UP. How I got into paddling was almost by mistake. When I moved here, I'm like, well, there's no ocean, right? And then I got invited on a Boundary Waters trip in 1986 to go with some Boy Scouts. And they were not prepared, and I didn't know what I was getting into. But despite that, I had a wonderful time, and it really ignited my love for the Boundary Waters. And since then, I don't know how many times I've been there, many. And that just kind of happened. And then I got into whitewater because that's the closest thing to ocean waves. And I moved away from the adrenaline and more towards the peace. And pretty much I'll paddle whitewater when I have to, but I don't go seeking it. And I mean, I can still paddle class 3-ish, whatever, but I don't. I go out on nice calm lakes and get into that meditative state.
Do you do mostly Wisconsin or mostly Boundary Waters canoeing or kind of a mix?
Well, I have a theory. So I know a lot of people with limited vacation. Right. And it's like they save up and save up and say, okay, we're going to the Boundary Waters for a week. And they go to the Boundary Waters for a week. And that's great. And then they come home and then they go back to work for 51 weeks. And I think that's just like gorging once a year, right? Just sitting down and just gorging on paddling or whatever, and then waiting and going hungry for 51 weeks. So I'm of the snack rather than gorge kind of person. So I do a couple long trips a year, usually the Boundary Waters, and I'll do like a 3 or 4 day trip down the lower Wisconsin River, which is 45 minutes from my house. So that's a beautiful stretch. You know, again, I go up north, northern Wisconsin, which, you know, it's a little known fact that Wisconsin has more lakes than Minnesota. So the land of 10,000 lakes, I think we have closer to 14. If you look at a map of Vilas County, it looks like someone took a shotgun and shot it, and then the holes filled up with water. It's full of these little beautiful lakes from 15 to 500 acres and more. I love my little 200 acre lakes. You just pop in and circumnavigate it as slow as you can and forage a little bit for some yummies and sit on the shore and look at things for a couple hours. And that really can restore me.
Oh, I believe it. And I love the snacking metaphor for canoe trips. You know, you can't just load it all into one, and it seems like it's become a way of life for you. So what was that turn for you, and how did you end up at Rutabaga Paddle Sports?
Well, it started like this. In 1990, after grad school, I moved back to Madison And I got a real job. It was a state job. I was working as an epidemiologist for the Public Health Bureau, doing breast and cervical cancer surveillance. And I really loved my work. But if you work for the government, at some point you run up against the, to make more money, you have to be a manager. And I was I'm not interested in being a manager. And frankly, they weren't as interested in having me because I wasn't the kind of person to follow the rules. So I was, while I was doing that, I worked 4 10-hour days. And then there was this little paddle sports shop called Rutabaga that was in an old grocery store just south of campus a little bit. And it was a dump. I mean, it was falling apart. And my joy days, like I did my work, I liked my work. And then I'd go to work on Fridays and sometimes Saturdays and go, man, this is, I leave work more energized than when I get there, right? Because no one comes into the shop with a problem like, you know, my toilet's broken or my car blew up or whatever. It's like when they come in, they're automatically related. They're automatically friends, right? So I got to talk to people, you know, 10 people a day on different kind of paddling stuff. And it was really fun. And in 94, the former owner moved us into a brand new building. And he said, hey, we need another manager. And I'm like, man, I got a pretty good deal here. I get the red and white paycheck every 2 weeks. And well, money's not great, but it's okay. And the more I thought about it, the more I went, you know what? I am not a not growing person. I have to keep growing. I have to keep learning. And I'll do this for a couple of years and then I'll figure out what I'm going to do next after I stop learning things. And here I am, you know, 25 something years later, still learning things. Because when you work in retail, I mean, every day is different. And if you look at the retail landscape in the past 25 years, I mean, the internet didn't exist when I bought this business. And all these things that have been disruptors in retail have been a learning experience for me. And it's been really cool, sometimes challenging, but cool. So anyway, in 2002, I turned 40. And the guy that owned it before me was kind of a difficult person to work for. And right before I turned 40, I made the pro con list. I said, I'm gonna quit. I'll give you the summer and then I'm done. And he said, if you do that, I'm screwed. I'm like, not my problem. And 2 weeks later, it happened to be for sale. So I bought it with a partner for 5 years. And then 2007, I bought it out. And here we are. So last year, well, 2 years ago, my lease ran out on the building I'm in. And I'm like, you know what? This building's falling apart. So I built a new shop and we opened on December 4th. And it's so nice to be in a space that is new and clean. For the most part, we are focused on canoes, kayaks, paddles, life jackets, and paddle sports accessories, fair amount of camping accessories. And that's mostly, so if someone came in and said, I've never done this before, I want to go to the Boundary Waters or I want to go someplace, I can give them everything they need to go with, you know, they just hand me a credit card and they leave with a boat and paddles and PFDs and port bags and portage packs and stoves and all that stuff.
If a customer comes in, how do you help them to find out what gear is a fit for them? And, you know, what kind of questions are you asking? And what are people looking for in a Boundary Waters canoe?
It's pretty easy, actually. We ask almost always the same questions. Okay, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? If you don't go anywhere now, where do you think you want to go? And you're doing local streams, big rivers, lakes. Do you want to go on a trip? Are you tripping? Oh. Are you just paddling, day paddling? How important is weight? How important is, you know, comfort is always important. And once we get an idea where they want to go and what they want to do, it's actually fairly easy. I've been doing this for, you know, 30 years. So it's okay. Well, here are three choices that would work great. So for example, if someone came in and said, hey, I want a solo canoe. I want to do small rivers around here, but I also want to be able to trip with it. Okay, give me some ideas of bodies of water you go to or want to go to, and that narrows it down. So I'll say to him, okay, well, you could look at a North Star Phoenix, you know, 14 and a half feet, pretty stable, maneuverable, decent hull speed, not great, but holds a load. And you could do that on the local rivers here, or you could take it to the boundary waters. You know, you're not going to be the first guy to finish at the end of the day, but, you know, last one off the water wins. You could look at a Swift Wildfire or a Kuwaitin 15, or if you want to go straight, you can look at a Prism. So if you want a little bit more durability, you could look at like the Eskeef Echo. You could look at some of the Royal X or T-Form X. Royal X is like Kleenex, right? It's going to be hard to get away from that. But T-Form X is the material. So we just give them choices. And then we have a little 2-acre pond behind our shop that has a oxygenator in it. So the water quality there is better than anything else in Madison. And they go out and we paddle around a little bit. And sometimes they go alone. Sometimes I'll go with them in another boat and just kind of talk them through it. And then they make a decision. And we don't really sell. We give them consultation and then they decide. And I had a guy that came in, actually, was it yesterday or the day before, who said, hey, I just bought a used Mad River Independence. He's about my size. He's about 200 pounds. And I said, cool. He said, but it seats too high. And I want to paddle with a kayak paddle. I said, okay, well, come over here. And I showed him some seats and some seat drops. I said, if you want to do it like an open top kayak, like a pack boat, we can do that. And he's like, oh, cool. And then he went, I'm a woodworker. And I said, take pictures of this stuff, go home and make it. And he left. And it was like, was that a good sales thing to do? No, whatever. He had the skills to do it. And I said, just promise me when you finish, you'll come back and show me the really cool stuff you built. And he left. And that's, he didn't need anything. So why sell him something? Right. And it was nice. And he'll be back. He'll come back and buy a paddle or something. That's okay. I mean, we try and meet people where they're at, right? He didn't need anything, so I didn't sell him anything.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And that seems like a great holistic approach, you know, both for, you know, your customers and for you and for your shop. When I was contacting you about coming on this podcast, you said you just listened to our previous podcast on 25 tips for a better boundary waters trip. And you took issue with our own Pete Marshall, who said that you don't necessarily need expensive gear to have a great trip to the boundary waters, which, you know, of course, where we're coming from is, you know, lowering the barrier to entry. We want people to get out there and not to feel intimidated by the gear. And the example was using an aluminum canoe versus a Kevlar canoe, which I remember when I first discovered Kevlar canoes, it was a total game changer. And I know that having a lighter canoe has allowed people like my dad to continue traveling extensively in the boundary waters into their 70s and 80s. And for me, it replacing that aluminum as a scrawny teenager was a game changer. But on the flip side, I just went up to Sawbill last week with my two kids in an aluminum canoe. And just with a few short portages on that trip, the aluminum canoe we have fit perfectly into our trip. Its stability was great. And, you know, if the kids were careless, it got banged up, it didn't really matter. So it struck me that the best gear is probably really what's best for your situation and your needs and your budget. And last week for me, that was the aluminum canoe. So what's your approach to gear? And when are those, you know, nicer pieces of gear? Where can you get those difference makers? Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And I didn't take issue with buying, you know, get the cheapest stuff you can get if it gets you out there. I think what he said is it doesn't really make that big of a difference. I'm like, whoa. Yes, it does. But let me state first that there is a fetishization of gear, right? And there are people that are gearheads. That's great. And I love them because they always want the latest and coolest. And sometimes the latest and coolest is really the latest and coolest. I mean, it's really, really cool. And it allows you to do things that you couldn't do before. You know, the Kevlar carbon sort of lightweight boat thing is a perfect example of that. I think aluminum canoes are great and they're durable, they're stable. I cannot portage one. I mean, I could, but I choose not to because, you know, I'm 61 and I've got some lower back problems. So having a lightweight boat allows me to continue to paddle. And just like your father, it doesn't mean that I don't have, you know, I've got a wood canvas boat at 16 feet that weighs 80 pounds. I very much do not like portaging that. But more than that, if someone picks it up, puts it on my shoulders, I can do a portage. It's getting it up and down And if I can flip the boat up and down or get it off my car 10 times, 15 times, 20 times, 50 times, the 51st time, I'm going to twist weird and it's going to go doink. And then I'm done paddling for 3 months. So I think that's, it's the proper gear, not necessarily the lightest or best. You know, we don't sell carbon fiber, foam cord, kayak paddles to everybody who comes into the shop. I mean, are they the best? No, they're the lightest. And for some people, lightest is best. If you're paddling shallow water and you want something more durable, that's fine. What we don't sell is like a $50 or $40 Carlisle paddle that you can get at the tractor store, because I don't think that gives you a good experience. You know, if that's what you have and you're happy with it, great. You know, go enjoy. But I think some people don't know it exists. And when you show it to them, they go, wow. And I had a couple come in a couple of weeks ago, and there's a new boat from North Star called the Pearl. 16 feet, 36 or 37 pounds, something like that. And they were, you know, in their late 70s, early 80s. And they picked it up and they went, whoa. I said, right. He said, this has made it possible for me to paddle another 10 years. I said, and bingo. Right. So you can get a less expensive canoe. I mean, you can buy an aluminum canoe for $500, right, in someone's backyard. But as I'll say sometimes, the most expensive canoe is the one you use twice. So if you spend $500 for an aluminum boat and use it twice, that's $250 per paddle, right? If you buy a Kevlar boat for $3,000 and use it 20 times, that's $150 per paddle. So the best value is the one you use the most. And if light helps you use it more, then it's worth it. And you tell people, buy the lightest paddle you, or the lightest canoe you choose to afford, because not everybody can afford, you know, $3,500 for a canoe. And I understand that. But I also understand that for someone in my age category, the lightest canoe may allow them to continue to paddle for another decade.
And is that kind of most of your clientele? Like, what are most people looking for in a canoe?
Well, it depends on the person. So, you know, we do have people that are boomers that come in and say, you know, I've been paddling in the Boundary Waters for 30 years. I just can't pick up my aluminum boat anymore, or my 70-pound Royal Lake boat, or whatever, right? And they paddle it and they go, well, not only is it lighter, it paddles better. You can get designs in composite you can't get in aluminum. You just can't bend the material, right? But if you're, you know, often we'll get in a young family, you know, 40-year-old, 35-year-old guy who's got 10-year-old and 8-year-old. And that's a pain point for outdoor people. You can't hike with them because they get tired, you know, or backpack. You can't cycle with them because they can't keep up. So what do you do with an 8 and 10-year-old? Well, you put them in a canoe, because then they're there, they're close, you can keep an eye on them, and they have fun. So you can still get outside with a young family, and that happens quite a bit. They want something less expensive, usually, and more durable, at least, you know, more cosmetically durable, right? You take some hits. And then we look at T-Formex or, you know, another material from North Star has IXP, and Swift has their Expedition Kevlar. Novacraft's got their Tough Stuff, it's called. And, you know, Winona has their Expedition layup too. And they have T-Formex as well. So you choose the boat that works best for you, and not the most expensive, because sometimes the most expensive is actually the worst boat for you.
And what would you say is the most game-changing development in canoe making over the last, since Kevlar?
It's more construction. So Kevlar it's not necessarily lighter than fiberglass. It's just more durable per pound, right? So you can use less of it. And if you look at how, you know, the outfitters have changed completely from, you know, the old days when it was a stack of aluminum boats to now it's a racks full of Kevlar, because when people rent, they want a rent light. What has happened over the past, oh, I'd say 15, 20 years, past 10 mostly, is a construction technique, resin infusion, where the boat is laid up, pieces are put into the mold dry, and then they put a vacuum bag on it, and then they pull a vacuum off one side and introduce the resin on the other, and it flows through. the cool thing about that is you can control the resin saturation down to the tablespoon. It's pretty cool. And so you can get a lighter boat. They're actually a little stronger because you don't have resin between layers. That's the scariest part of a hand laid up boat, which is where there's no vacuum or anything, because you can build them. But if you don't squeegee them right, or something goes a little bit off, you might get a thin layer of resin between two layers of cloth. And resin has no structural capacity. It's like brittle, right? If you take some example, you take some sugar and you boil it till it's a syrup and put it on, let it cool, and you can snap it in half. Well, resin, when it's cured, is pretty much the same. So you want enough resin to hold the layers together, but not so much that it puddles or gets layers, and then not so much that it gets dry. So you want to balance that. And the people that do infusion are geniuses at that.
So let's talk about some of the other types of gear that are important to paddling, PFDs and the paddles themselves. What are some of the types of paddles considerations that people are looking at when they're coming to your shop, and what are some of the good upgrades that people have enjoyed?
Well, this is a case where I say, you know, buy the lightest paddle you choose to afford if you are paddling flat water, because you pick your boat up, you know, multiple times a day if you're doing portages. But if you're, you know, lifting the paddle 10,000 times a day, 15,000 times a day, light will help you from getting tired. And that's great. If you're paddling in water that's, you know, 6 inches deep once in a while, maybe you don't want the ultralight, because you might be, you know, hitting the bottom. But for lake country, light's great. The other thing is traditional paddles don't get enough love, because everybody thinks, oh my gosh, they're going to break because there's nothing on the bottom. It's like, you know what? People have been using traditional paddles for hundreds, if not, you know, thousands of years without anything on the bottom to protect the bottom. Well, they're not for pry bars, right? They're for paddling. And if you are careful with them, and if you hit occasional rock, it's going to scuff or scratch, or it might chip. Those are easily repaired. And I have probably a dozen traditional paddles, and I really like how they feel on the water. They are a little easier to teach people how to do corrective strokes, you know, J strokes and things like that, just because the blade's longer and extends further behind the paddler, and it's more like a small rudder. So it does help teach. I had a friend staying with us at a little cabin. It's a friend from Italy. She's never been any place like the Northwoods. It's just, she's from an urban area. She went to fashion school in Milan. So she was paddling solo within an hour using a traditional paddle with some techniques that I've, you know, that I use. So like I developed them. There's nothing new under the sun when it comes to paddling technique, right? And there's no right or wrong. There's just effective and ineffective, or less effective. So I think sometimes people get into the, you know, that's the wrong way to do it. It's like, well, that, you know what, maybe, but if it works for you, fine.
I'm hearing you about the number of times you pick it up a day, that, you know, if you're going on long, long trips, that can really make a difference. And, but again, I'm in the 8 to 10 year old kid set. And so sometimes those wood paddles, it's just like, here you go.
Yep.
If it breaks, it's not the end of the world, as long as you're not way out in the wilderness when that happens.
You know, so, it's my experience is paddles don't usually break when you're paddling with them. They break when you run over them with your truck. And I've seen this at put-ins, and it's just painful. You know, don't set your paddle, don't lean it against your car, and then it falls over. And then you try and close your tailgate, and it pinches. So I've never broken a paddle while paddling.
Yeah. Yeah. Or keep a clean camp, you know, don't leave your paddles lying around on the rocks in your camp. You know, as soon as you show up to the camp, lean them up against something and kind of get them out of the way, so you're not stepping on them and accidentally breaking them and stranding yourself.
Absolutely. Well, you're going to carry a spare anyway. I mean, everybody should carry, my opinion is, one paddle for every two, as far as spares go.
Well, and speaking of safety, that's also kind of a factor too, when you're choosing gear. You know, it's not just kind of about about comfort and lightness, and then, you know, durability, but also safety. And I think that that's especially true with PFDs. And so I kind of grew up not wearing a PFD, and things happen really fast out there, and it can save your life. And that is critical. And then, of course, having kids too. So is that a factor too, when people are choosing PFDs? And as kind of a PFD noob, what can you tell me about what to look for in a personal flotation device?
One that you will wear. And that's
for that reason I just said, right?
Well, right. And I mean, I paddle solo all the time, and I never go out without a PFD, even if I'm like 10 feet from shore, you know, because, you know, things happen, right? Wave comes up, something tips me over, I hit my head on the gunwale, and I'm kind of confused. And, you know, there's a young person that died on one of our local rivers a couple months ago. It's a shallow river. It's very shallow, but it turned a corner in a bend near a big bluff, and there was this deep spot. And he may or may not have been drinking a little bit, I don't know, a little bit of beer, but all of a sudden he went down and he did not come up. And nobody was wearing a PFD because, hey, why should you wear a PFD? It's only 6 inches deep. Well, you can drown in 4 inches of water, right? And I'm a big fan of not drowning. So the most important PFD, the best one, is the one you'll wear. And, you know, when I started paddling, there were the orange extra sports with the big slabs that fits you if you're a tube shape and don't fit if you're not. And people didn't wear them. So the game changer for us is in, never exactly when, it was probably in the late 90s. Philip Curry is the founder of Lotus Designs and took apart his wife's sports bra and used it as a pattern to make a PFD. And it was a radical idea that instead of making flotation fit your body, you said, make the clothing, make the sit, and then make it float. And for women especially, it was the game changer because there's a lot more variation in women's shapes than there is in men's shapes. And, you know, unisex back then, that fits one sex, right? Fits guys. And especially larger busted women, there's nothing for them. When Philip made that PFD, it was like, oh my gosh. And people started wearing them. And then other manufacturers started picking up that, you know, not everything has to be a slab. And he sold Lotus Designs, you know, 3 or 4 years later to Patagonia. And Patagonia ran it to the ground. I don't think it was important enough and wasn't enough of a profit center. But be that as it may, his non-compete ran out and he started Astral Designs. And continued with his work. And he's a revolutionary when it comes to PFDs. And everybody else said, you know what, this is a good idea. So all of our companies that we carry, I don't carry a PFD that I wouldn't wear. Because why should I make someone else wear something that's not comfortable? So I actually wear a woman's PFD quite a bit. Because if it fits a woman, it'll certainly fit me. And super comfortable. And, you know, the only downside is if it's really hot, you've got some R22 insulation strapped to your body. Okay. So splash yourself a little bit. And being hot's better than being dead.
Are all PFDs hot, even the most comfortable ones? Or are there design factors or material factors that change that comfort factor?
There's some PFDs that have been designed with a foam on the inside that separates it a little bit from your body using some dimples or some scrim fabric and some holes in it for ventilation. So there's some of that. The other thing is the amount of foam that touches your body is much different than it was, you know, 25 years ago where you had, you know, basically your whole torso was covered, right? Well, any foam above your chest doesn't do anything. Right? Because it's not in the water. So over the years, flotation has moved down into the front. So you have a little bit of a dad bod, but you float facing up and it doesn't get in the way. So there's no good PFD that has a lot of foam on the sides where your arm would rub. And there's very little, very good PFDs that have foam like above your shoulders. the one case that's not true is not in paddle sports. It's in, like, you see water skiers and wakeboarders and stuff have a PFD that's got much more flotation on it and a lot of flotation above the shoulders, right above the armpits. That's because they're going to hit the water at 30 miles an hour. So they need that. For paddlers, we don't really need that impact resistance.
I ordered one online and the fit is terrible and it's uncomfortable. And I think your point is really well taken about having one that can, that fits you and is more comfortable and that you would wear, because that's something I need to do.
Well, talk to someone who's had 30 life jackets on, right? So, you know, getting one on the internet is all well and good if you've got return privileges, but also, there's adjustability factors, and people often don't know how to fit a PFD. And if you get them from the factory, sometimes all the straps are cinched up tight just to make it, you know, ship easier and look better on the hanger. So the first thing I do when I fit a PFD is open everything, all the straps all the way out, and then put it on somebody, and then start at the bottom and work your way out.
That makes a ton of sense. And I think getting fit for a better PFD is at the top of my list for this off season. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back with Darren Bush.
The Boundary Waters is more than a stunning collection of pristine water, trees, and ancient rocks. It's the people, the memories, the life-changing experiences that make this wilderness such an important part of our lives. Connect with this special place by subscribing to Friends of the Boundary Waters newsletter or following us on social media. Visit www.friends-bwca.org to learn more.
So besides paddling, you also do canoe camping, and that's a big part of the trip for you. Do you have any favorite pieces of camping gear? What's your favorite piece of camping gear for a paddle trip, or your top three?
So if I'm not portaging cast iron, I love an 8-inch Dutch oven, and I love baking. So the other one is, we've got a company we found in Germany called Petromax. Petromax is a German company. They make some stuff that is really cool. They're mostly known for their lanterns, you know, the ones that can blind you, you know, like it's like a 500 watt bolt. They're amazing. The Amish use them a lot, actually, because they're indestructible. But they also make some cook gear. They make a thing it's like a shallow paella pan, three legs on it, the legs screw off. And you can cook, you know, I cook bacon or sausage on it. And then when it gets too much grease, I just tap a corner of it and lower it in the sand, and the grease runs off into the fire and burns. And you can adjust it by dragging it in and out of the fire and move it over and have a cool spot and a hot spot. I've made, you know, roti, which is, you know, basically an Indian pita bread. And even butter chicken, anything you can make on a griddle, you can make on that thing. As you might guess from my responses, I kind of like food. I think it's important to eat well. I also have a reflector oven that I love dearly. I import them from Sweden, from a sweet little old guy in Sweden who makes them. And they're very small, very light. And, you know, I've made eggplant parmesan before on the trail, which was stupid, but it was fun. But baking, you know, making little pizzas, things like that, there's nothing better than a reflector oven because you can watch the whole thing happen. And once you understand how to position it and how to make it work temperature wise, then you can make anything with it. As far as non-cooking stuff, I really like Cook Custom Sewing. Makes some really nice like seat pads. I mean, they're known for their portage packs, and their portage packs are indestructible, right? I have one. The first damage that was to it, probably 10 years old, was a chipmunk chewing a corner off of it, because it's amazing how fast they can chew. And I wasn't hanging it because it wasn't night. It was just sitting in camp, and I look over and there's this hole. But he also makes like seat pads, and he makes one that I think everybody should have if it fits your boat, that the space between the edge of the seat and the boat, there's that little rectangular gap, right? On most boats. And there's little pockets that fit down in there. And It's perfect for, you can leave it open and put a water bottle sitting there, or you can, you know, throw in what you'd put in a thwart bag and have it right there for you. It uses dead space. And I mean, that's Dan, right? I mean, he's always thinking about stuff because he's an engineer, and I could tell Dan stories that'll blow you away about stuff that he's invented, not in his paddling life, but in his work life. He's a total genius. But I love those. I like thwart bags. I think everybody should have one, just because it's like a glove compartment for your canoe, right? It's right there in front of you. One thing I do like is I've got a twig stove, and I've never had anybody give me a straight answer if twig stoves are okay during fire bans, right? Because it's contained, right? I don't know. So I don't use them when there's a fire ban, but it's titanium. It's little, it's called an Emberlit, and it's a backup, you know, because things break, right? But you can still cook with it. Petromax also has called a fire kettle that is a chimney, kind of a chimney stove. It's got you put your water in the outside jacket, and then you put it on a little pot, and then the fire goes up to the middle, and you use pine cones or whatever, and it boils water really fast. And so what most people do when they cook, the first thing you want is boiling water, right? Because you want to make your coffee or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Or if the sun's going down and you got to hang the bear bag and you need to boil the water and do the dishes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of new stoves out that are really cool. You know, BioLite makes a twig stove that uses a fan, so there's like almost no smoke. I mean, the reason I had to bring up stoves is I have like 9 of them already. And if I do have one gear fetish, it's stoves. And I still have this Svea 123R that I got when I was a Boy Scout in, you know, 1976 or something like that. And it sounds like a, you know, like a rocket taking off. So it's kind of loud for wilderness. But if I dropped it and it went down a 50-foot cliff and hit a boulder on the bottom, I could probably still cook with it. So the thing about the efficient stoves, like the JetBoil or the Reactor from MSR, is a lot of people take canister fuel and they can triple the amount of time you get out of a canister just because they're so efficient. And there's, you know, the religious discussion about whether you should use, you know, canisters because, you know, you create waste, you know, create metal, or use, you know, liquid fuel. And, you know, there's positives and negatives. You know, if you spill a couple capfuls of white gas into the water in the Boundary Waters, you've just polluted a lot, right?
Right.
And canisters don't do that. On the other side, you have to pack out canisters, but you can recycle them. So I use both. I don't often use gas, like white gas stoves in the Boundary Waters, just because I'm clumsy and I don't want to spill white gas.
That makes sense. Yeah, I'm still rocking a Coleman dual fuel from my younger days, which got me across the country and back because I could just fill it up with unleaded at the gas station. And it was easy wherever you were to have fuel when I was living outside for a couple months.
Well, the MSR, you know, the Whisperlite and the XGK and all those have dual fuel capabilities. The one white gas stove I use a lot is I've got a Coleman. I think it's a 503. And basically what it is, the bottom of it looks like a Coleman lantern. The top looks like one of the burners of the two burners. And I don't know how long they made them, but I came across one in a garage sale and I snapped it up and it wasn't working. It was $5. I put a new generator in and it's great. It's probably the best one for cooking because the burner's big and super adjustable. So I can make an omelet, right? It's hard to make an omelet with a more modern stove, right? Because they just put off so much heat. You burn it before you cook the top. But yeah, we could do a whole show on stoves.
Right. Yeah. Well, all that gear sounds really exciting. And hopefully that'll get people thinking about gear that could help them on their own trips. So what's it like for you having access to all the gear in one place? Is it tempting? Is it like a kid in the candy store? And then how do you navigate that in terms of your own personal supply?
I mean, the first 4 years when I was working part-time at the shop, I don't think I ever took home a paycheck. I was in graduate school and broke and had no money. And then all of a sudden I have a little bit of pin money and was able to get you know, a couple boats and then another boat and then paddles and life jackets. So I got a lot of my gear the first 4 years I worked there. And then when you do it professionally, I do some product design for some of our manufacturers. I've been involved with some paddle designs with Bennett Branches. So those show up, you know, as samples because we're going back and forth trying to figure out what we're going to do as far as, you know, blade shape and things like that. Plus people just give me stuff to try and tell me what you think. And then it just kind of accumulates. So I have more gear than I need. One of my former employees, a young kid who just moved, he said, I want to get into paddling more. And like, I don't have any gear because, you know, when I was here, I was in school and broke. And so we went down to the basement yesterday and just kind of picked through stuff, found him a cook kit, and found him a couple dry bags and a little 6-inch cast iron pan, which I really didn't need because I have a 7-inch cast iron pan. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing, but I've come to the conclusion that if you accumulate gear, it's fine as long as you pass off the stuff that you're not using. I mean, if I don't touch it in a year, it's gone. And I don't sell it because, frankly, I didn't pay anything for it. A lot of that stuff is samples. And, you know, why should I get $20 for a cook kit that cost $50 5 years ago? It's like, here, take it. So my younger staff and my younger friends and people that are just getting started, we go shopping sometimes in the gear room.
So, Darren, in talking to you about your store, it really comes through that you're there to work with your customers and to support people, not only as customers, but also as part of a paddling community. Can you tell us about your experience with the paddling community and then also, you know, your work with Canoocopia, which for people who don't know is the big conference in the spring in the Madison area?
I can tell you what I say all the time. It's all about community. Nothing else matters. Zero. Our mission statement says that Rutabaga Paddle Sports exists to create and foster communities to help enjoy the outdoors, help enjoy and protect the outdoors. You'll notice what's not mentioned in that mission statement. There's nothing about paddling.
Right.
Right. Because paddling is the mechanism by which I create communities. And if for some reason paddling disappeared tomorrow because, you know, someone waved a magic wand and we're not allowed to paddle, I'd find another way to create communities. That's what I do. And there's a, you know, E.M. Forster quote from Howard's End that says, only connect. And connections between people is what keeps us human, right? And we create communities and foster communities. So the paddle sports community already exists. My goal is to make sure that those people can talk to each other and can find ways to connect. And I have some of my best friends in the world I met through the show. And they walk in the door, we already have a connection because we already love the same things. Even if they're brand new, they have a desire, right? And I had a gentleman come in 4 or 5 years ago and he just hit it off, right? He and his wife, and just a wonderful guy. And his brother had been ill. And I just said, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? And he said, he could die. I said, right. And we all die. And he just kind of looked at me and he said, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen is a really good mantra. And because it's never going to be the worst, right? What's the worst thing that can happen in the Boundary Waters? You know, someone gets, you know, terminally ill. But that doesn't happen very often. What's the second worst thing? Someone gets food poisoning, breaks a bone or something like that. What's the third worst thing? Their canoe blows away. All this stuff is preventable, right? Except for the health stuff. You know, I had a heart attack last year, 4 days before we opened the shop. I'm not going to spend my life within 10 minutes of an ER. I'm not going to do it, right? You can't do that. Anyway, this gentleman was just, we just hit it off. He's probably about my age. And last year, his wife passed away. She had cancer. And we've talked on the phone like 4 or 5 times since then. He's come into the shop. He hadn't bought anything from me for like 5 years. But I mean, so what? You know, and he walked into the shop recently and just threw his arms around me and we started crying. And I said, I'm so sorry. And he said, hey, you know, I'm sorry too. So I'm kind of helping him through his grieving process just because he's my friend. And, you know, if he never bought anything from me ever again, that would be okay. He probably will.
Right.
Another story I can tell you there real quick is a woman came into the shop 4 years ago and said, I've got these 4 wood canvas canoes and I've had them for a long time. One of them, I went on my honeymoon in and I want to dispose of them. How much are they worth? And I said, well, it totally depends on their condition. But something about me said, that's not the question she wanted to know. The question she wanted to know is, how can I get rid of these? Right. And I said, so do you want the most money for them or do you want them to go to the right homes? And she actually walked behind the counter and put her arms around me and said, I just want them to go to the right people. I said, well, I can do that. So I looked at all the boats and then I started thinking about it. So who would benefit most from these boats? And there's an 18-footer, big 18-foot Old Town. And I said, you know, our Old Town rep is a gem. He's got a big family. This would be perfect for him. So we got it to him and he was just beyond himself. He was so happy. And I said, the only thing you need to do is take pictures and send them to the original owner. He said, yes. I can do that. Right. And this happened with these 4 boats. It just happened because I have a large community and I know a lot of people. It just presented itself, right? It's like, okay, here's the right place for this boat. And, you know, one was a grad student who had a young family who loved to fly fish and loved to be outside, but he couldn't afford a boat. And he got one of them. He was just like, I mean, he was crying. And his kids got pictures of him and he's got at that point, a 4-year-old and a 6 or 7-year-old. And she got what she wanted, right? Which was to connect to other people, to find the people that would take that gear and take it to its next level. And I have friends that went on their honeymoon to Kunikulkia. They go every year on their anniversary. So I think you're getting the point here. It's not about stuff. It's not about commerce. It's not about making money. Do I need to make a living? Yeah, I do. And I do. I do okay. Some years better than others, right? But I don't care, right? I'm sitting here smiling right now because I'm so happy that I can tell this story. And yeah, I need to sell gear, but what I really want is connect people together because that's what keeps this community vibrant and growing. That's what gets the 30-year-old with the 6-year-old and the 8-year-old with then the 40-year-old, the 16-year-old and the 18-year-old going to the Boundary Waters, right? And that's what gets the mentors because there's a lot of wisdom out there. So this is why I do what I do, right? I keep learning, I keep growing, and I keep connecting people. And that's what my passion in life is.
That's beautiful. Thank you for that. And what do you see that other people can do to strengthen the paddle community?
Share your knowledge. Don't be dogmatic. Don't think you know everything because you don't. But if you've been at a place where you see someone coming into, like, you know, if you're 50 and you took your kids through the 40-year-old phase and you're talking to a 30-year-old, just say, you know, this worked for me. This is what I did. And it was great. And, you know, like, I share a lot of, I don't say wisdom, but experiences. Like Darren's rule is 15 minutes for every year of age for a kid. So if they're 3, you got 45 minutes for you have to get out. If you're 4, it's an hour. And that way you want them saying, oh, I want to get back in the boat. If they're crying after an hour and a half, you'll never get them in there again. So my friends with 4-year-olds are like, okay, we're going to go in the river for an hour and then we're going to get out and we're going to play in the sand. We're going to do whatever. And then we'll do it again. And I've found that with my kids, that worked really, really well. And obviously every kid's different, but you know, it's if people wonder, you know, how do I do this? It's like, well, there's a good place to start, right?
Can you just briefly tell me what Kunikulkia is and who participates?
So Kunikulkia is the largest paddle sport event in the country, possibly the world. I don't know if a bigger one, but it's 100,000 square feet of floor space plus another 60,000 feet of lobby and speaker rooms. So basically it's 3 things. And first it's a rendezvous. And a friend of mine said, if a voyager came back and forward in time, and woke up at Kunikulkia, like, oh, we're at a rendezvous. right? So it's first thing is it's a gathering. And second, it's an educational, you know, we have 100 speaker slots with people from everything like how to paddle with your kids to I went to the Noatak River to how to cook, how to pack. I mean, if you want to learn, it's the best place to go and learn because there's just so many people that are willing to share their knowledge. And we have one speaker that talks about how to paddle, you know, how old's too old? How do you paddle till you're in your 80s? And it's packed because people want to keep going. And, you know, there's things about cooking. We do aluminum chef, which is basically Iron Chef with camp gear from MSR. And we have a couple of experienced outdoor chefs and then outdoor, you know, chefs. And then we have one professional James Beard nominated chef that comes in and he loves to camp. And, you know, Luke's a dear friend of mine. He owns a really nice restaurant and he goes off against these guys like Marty, who's a former park ranger in the St. Louis County down in St. Louis. And then a woman, Mona, who dehydrates a lot of her own food. So you get these different perspectives, right? And so that educational component is super important to me. The third thing is it's commerce, right? I need to sell stuff to pay for the hall, right? It costs six figures. But I love the ability for a customer to talk directly to the CEO of the company. It's pretty cool when they talk to the founder. And, you know, they go to the North Star booth and there's Ted Bell, right? And they go to the Swift booth and there's Bill Swift. And they go to Winona booth and there's Mike Chikanowski. So they can talk to the people that started, you know, that company. But the other cool thing is the people that work that booth, some of them see customers like never, right? And we had Winona brought a couple guys a couple of years ago who worked building boats. And, you know, they're not sales guys, but people are like, hey, this is a cool boat. He's like, yeah, I built that. Whoa, you built that? It's like, yeah, I built that. Let me show you how this works. And these guys just grow. You can just see their chests swelling and the buttons popping off their vests, right? Because they get to talk to someone who actually cares what they make. And it's not just an assembly line where I make this widget and it goes out to, you know, who knows. So that sort of connection again between the person that makes the stuff and the person that uses the stuff is super powerful. So that allows us to sell gear, which is great. And, you know, things are on sale so people can get a little bit of a deal. And again, back to what I was saying before, it's community. That's all that matters.
Well, I really hope I get to go this year and meet some of those people myself. And can you tell us kind of how people can get in touch with or where can people find you, Cornucopia and Rutabaga?
Well, cornucopia.com works. Also, rutabaga.com, and then click on the, you know, events button or the Cornucopia button. That will show who's attending. It'll show who's speaking and all that. One of the other things that I didn't mention is we sell booths to people that aren't directly related to the shop. So outfitters and guides, there's people that make kind of cool gear that isn't really commercially viable for like retail or for a shop, but it's cool. And so we let them come and sell their stuff. And, you know, does it compete with us directly? I don't really care. It doesn't matter because it's cool and, you know, help young people grow. Agawa is one brand that I love. They make axes and saws, and now they're just expanding. And it's two guys from Canada who make really cool stuff. And I think they started coming as direct vendors and then they got into retail. So we started buying the stuff and selling it there. So it's, again, part of the community is it's not so much about, well, I don't want people to sell stuff that competes against me. I want customers to find the cool stuff, right? So that works. And again, that helps pay for the hall a little bit. But if you want to go to pretty much anywhere in the upper Midwest, you're going to find an outfitter or two. I mean, the Boundary Waters is well represented there. You know, Steve from Spirit of the Wilderness is always there. Most of the chambers of commerce from, you know, Lake and Cook County and from Northern Wisconsin are there. So we actually have a pretty sizable Iowa contingency that comes because Iowa has some really cool paddling in it that no one ever pays attention to and they want people to know. So outfitters from outside of the country, people from, you know, do trips in Baja. So if you want to get educated, both from the the speakers, but also from the exhibitors. And they're just there to help, right? Do they want to sell a trip? Yeah. But really, they're excited that you're excited.
Well, yes. And friends, the Boundary Waters loves being at Canucopia, and we'll be there this year. And, you know, we've connected with you at Canucopia over the years. And what do you like about Friends of the Boundary Waters, and what about our work resonates with you?
Well, I mean, the biggest one, obviously, is your advocacy work for, you know, anti-mining. And, you know, I'm not anti-mining. I'm anti-mining in stupid places. And that's one of the stupidest places to ever put a hard rock mine. And the Prove It First is a beautiful piece of legislation. I hope it goes through. I don't know if it has yet.
Yeah, that used to be a law in Wisconsin, and it's a law we've proposed in Minnesota, where before risky sulfide mining would move forward, there should be at least one example in the United States where it's been done safely. And we're still working on that and spreading the word.
You guys spend a lot of time and a lot of money on advocacy for keeping the Boundary Waters the Boundary Water. And that's worth it. You know, we're, I'd say, significant donors, but everybody should be. I mean, if you got $50 in your wallet, send it to the friends. And, you know, this is an unsolicited testimonial. You guys do great work. And I like the fact that it's called Friends of the Boundary Waters, because again, that gets back to my thing about community. It's about everybody getting together who love the Boundary Waters and kicking in whatever they can, right? And that's one thing. The other thing is just your passion for the Boundary Waters comes through in everything you do, and making it an educational experience for people. You want people to know more about it, and that's so they'll enjoy it when they go, but also so they'll protect it when they go. So I'm very appreciative and grateful for what you do.
Thank you, Darren. And thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you and hearing your stories and also picking your brain about gear. It's been really fun. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend and leave us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be covering a wide range of recreational topics this season, from hiking trails to tips and tricks, and we'll meet some great personalities from the BWCA along the way, so be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Big Red Canoe is a presentation of Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. Original music by Surge and the Swell. I'm Dave Meyer, and we'll see you next time on Big Red Canoe.
Thanks to the dedication of people from across the nation, we've made incredible victories in the fight against copper sulfide mining. For now, we've stopped this polluting industry from putting a shovel in the ground. But the threat is still there. That's why we've been working to pass a Prove It First bill in Minnesota. The law is simple. Before a copper sulfide mine in Minnesota can be permitted, the Prove It First law would require independent scientific proof that just one copper sulfide mine has operated in the United States for at least 10 years without causing pollution, and that one mine has been closed for at least 10 years without polluting. It's common sense. Let's protect our clean water. Let's pass the Prove It First bill.